The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
The darkness has found you.
Welcome to the Horror Hill Midseason Special. I'm your guest host, Otis Gyrie, and I'm thrilled you could join me tonight. You can also keep up with me weekly on my show, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which is now in its 9th season. Capture the magic or the madness from the very beginning, and check out the show today. You'll be glad that you did. Tonight, while we settle in and wait for season 5, we bring you two performances by Jason Hill that have aired previously on our Chilling Tales for Dark Nights podcast. Our first tale, featuring special guest Justine Anastasia, features a woman struggling to balance a budding career with a new living situation, but issues that arise in her apartment that are less than favorable, and the tenants that cohabitate the building, well, they turn out to be even worse. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy ad-free versions of this and all our other episodes, as well as hundreds of tales from our audio archives dating back to 2012, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. And you'll get instant access from our friends at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Thank you for your support. Now, allow me to escort you to a place where the sun dies and nightmares come to life. Welcome, listener, to the Horror Hill. You haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you. And now, without further ado, from author Don Shea, I give you Body Alteration.
Karen woke in a sweat, the peripheral of her dream slowly dissipating. Again, that smell. She took a long, deep breath and groggily massaged her nose, though it did not help. It never did. In fact, the nauseous stench of putrid flesh seemed to linger for hours after the dream had ended, almost as if the scent escaped the confines of her nightmare and hauntingly resided in her nostrils. She knew it was all in her head, but she couldn't seem to shake the feeling of the dreamscape. She could still remember the man was there, face shaded by the bill of his cap. He was looming over her, forcing her to choke down rotten meat mixed with hard bits, like pebbles. She gagged thinking about it. She could never see his face, and she wondered what horrors lurked under the bill of that hat. He never spoke, only grunted. She looked around the room and saw that it was still dark out. No use trying to go back to sleep, she thought. You might as well get on with the day. Shower. She needed to start with a shower. Maybe it would help get the smell out of her nose. She strode to the bathroom and, once there, stared into the mirror. There was a smear of blood on her face. She wondered how it got there. She checked her reflection for any wounds. Finding none, she checked her pillow. All was fine in the bedroom, not so much as a sheet out of place. She started to undress without giving it another thought when she heard it. The clanking sound of old pipes and a drill. The guy downstairs. He's such a weirdo, she thought to herself. She'd only heard of him through her landlady, Miss Wyndham. Accordingly, she had the main floor. Lucy lived upstairs in the loft. And David? Daniel? His name eluded her, had the basement. It had worked out pretty well so far. Mostly everyone kept to themselves, especially that guy. He rarely left the house that she knew of. Miss Wyndham had mentioned he was in some security business that allowed him to work from home. She still thought that was odd. How did he get food, she wondered. She had never seen him go to the grocery store. He was generally quiet except for the occasional construction noise, and every so often, a weird smell. She put it off to old plumbing in the house. Turning on the shower, she didn't have time to worry about the basement dude. She had so much stuff to do today, she was anxious about getting it all accomplished. She focused on the warm shower, letting the anxiety melt away. After dressing, she grabbed her purse and keys and headed out the door to the street. Just as she started down the stairs, the basement door slammed shut. Seeing no one while continuing to her car, she looked around, threw her purse in the back, and slid behind the steering wheel. She was off. The first stop was to the florist to go over orders. You could not have a big southern party without an abundance of flowers. They couldn't be just any flowers either. They had to be perfect. They had to be the most eloquent assortment for the grandest family in Georgia, the McMahons. Her anxiety returned at the thought. It was the first big event she had acquired since venturing out on her own 3 months ago. The party had to be impeccable, down to the very last detail. Her career may very well be riding on this one event. If she nailed it, she would be swamped with Georgia's most affluent and lavish clients. She was so lost in her fantasy, she almost missed the turn for the florist. With quick footwork, she made a left-hand turn barely in time. As the car lurched sideways, she heard a thud from her trunk. Must have left something in there for my pickups yesterday, she thought. No big deal. She would check it when she got back to her shop. She pulled into a parking spot right in front of the florist and jumped out, anxious to start picking out the most stunning bouquets money could buy. It was the longest and most tedious day Karen could remember when she finally made her way back home. She had been so busy she had no chance to eat, and every part of her body ached. She had every intention of taking a long, hot bath, followed by the warmth of her favorite flannel pajamas. Supper would be popping a lean cuisine in the microwave and getting her nightly glass of Pinot Noir, then falling onto the couch to watch the Love Boat reruns. She was such a sucker for classic TV shows. As she parked the vehicle, she once again heard something slide. As she went to grab her purse, she remembered she had never checked the trunk to see what she had left in there. She bit her lip, hoping it was nothing perishable. She clicked the button on her key fob and saw the trunk pop up in the rear view. Starting around the car, she looked inside and noticed a small metal box lying flat. She picked it up curiously. Was it a part of the car? It hadn't seemed to affect the performance of the car. Scanning the interior trunk space, there was no obvious place for it. She tossed it back in the trunk, telling herself she would have her dad look at it when he came to visit in a few weeks. She shut the trunk, locked the doors with a click of the button, and headed towards the house's steps. She noticed movement out of the corner of her eye from the basement window. Someone had been looking through. Maybe the weirdo was watching for her. Karen, get it together. He's probably busy playing Dungeons and Dragons or something, she grimaced. She ran up the stairs and into the house without another thought, to laze the rest of the evening away. A few days later, her party planning was done. 2 days away from the big event, Karen was sitting on her couch making her list and checking it twice. She wanted to ensure that she had it all together and everything was ready to go. She smiled to herself as she read, realizing she had done it. She had planned the perfect party. Just as she was about to close her notebook, she heard a whoosh from the kitchen that sounded like a fully open fire hydrant, followed by a stream of water rushing from her kitchen into the living room. Shit, she thought, jumping up and starting for the kitchen. Water was pouring from the cabinet beneath the sink. She opened it up and was immediately drenched in spray and water. She remembered the water valve was in the basement. Oh, great, she thought, as she stood and looked around. She'd have to get the basement boy to turn the water off. Then she would have to call the super, Harold, to see if he would come to fix the pipe. What a mess to clean up. She walked to the door at the top of the basement stairs and stared at it. She felt queasy. She was not looking forward to this interaction, but it had to be done. She hesitated, and then knocked, softly at first, then harder. She heard scuffling behind the door and she waited. After a brief moment, just as her hand was poised to knock again, she heard heavy footsteps coming up the stairs. She held her breath as she waited for him to open the door. A bolt lock clicked, and the door swung open to reveal a man about 5'9", mid to late 30s, with close-cropped black hair and a round belly, which she presumed was from beer and lack of activity. He wore a hunter green robe, hanging open to reveal a somewhat stained white tee underneath. He had on a pair of jeans and flip-flops. She laughed to herself as she gazed at his ensemble. Oh, hi, I'm Karen, you're... He cut her off.
I know who you are.
She gazed at him momentarily as they had never met in person and wondered how he knew for certain who she was. She smiled politely and attempted to look down the stairs behind him, but it was so dark she couldn't see anything. Okay, well, I had a pipe burst in my apartment and I was wondering if you could turn the water off for me until I can have the super come fix it. He did not directly look her in the face, more towards the left, and he didn't raise his eyes to look at her.
Want me to come take a look? I'm pretty handy with fixing stuff.
She looked like someone had slapped her across the face. No, that's fine. If it's no trouble, could you just turn the water off?
Suit yourself.
He spun and shut the door. As the door swung shut in her face, she got a faint whiff of a vaguely familiar smell. Just as the foggy memory was coming to her, streaming water swamped her bare feet. She shook her head and whispered, "Thanks for nothing, creep," and headed back to her kitchen for the mop bucket. Several hours and many beers later, the super had fixed the pipe. She had cleaned the mess and was back in the water business. She had just sat down to go over delivery schedules of equipment for the next day when she heard a knock at the door. She rolled her eyes, grunted, and thought, "Who the fuck is it now? Better be a Girl Scout with a wagon full of cookies or they can take a fucking hike." She opened the door to reveal Miss Wyndham, her landlady. She looked as refined and impressive as ever in her horn-rimmed glasses, gray hair pulled back into a sleek bun, and her signature brocade jacket with white slacks. She looked Karen up and down, as she often did, and gave her a fake smile. "Karen, oh my goodness, are you all right? Harold called me and said he had to come and fix a pipe in your apartment. What happened?" she asked, slightly flustered as she was examining her hardwood floors. Yes, ma'am. Something happened with one of the pipes under the sink. Harold fixed it right up and everything is working as it should. He said no permanent damage. I caught it right when it started." Karen motioned towards the kitchen and the offending sink. "Good, good. Glad to hear that. I heard you met Douglas as well." Karen stared at her quizzically. Miss Wyndham clicked her tongue and said, "The young man that lives in the basement." Recognition struck like a lightning bolt, and Karen switched her weight from one foot to the other. "Yes, I did meet him. I had to go and have him turn the water off until Harold could get here," Karen admitted. "Dear Douglas would have been glad to help you. He's quite the Bob Vila if you should ever need anything else. He
He's lived here for a long time. And he's helped with many projects over the years. Job performance superb, said Miss Wyndham, hands clasped to her chest. Thanks, I'll keep that in mind, Karen smiled. Okay, sweetie, well, I have to run. I've got an appointment at the hair salon. This rat's nest won't fix itself, you know. She blew Karen a kiss, and in a whirlwind, she was gone. Moments later, thoughts of Lucy crossed Karen's mind. Where was she? She hadn't seen her in 3 weeks, maybe more. She had been super busy planning the party, and Lucy worked killer hours at the bar, but they always ran into each other at least a couple of times a week, either coming or going. She scratched her head and tried to remember the last time she saw her for sure. Given up, she decided to go up to Lucy's apartment just to check on her. Maybe she was sick, or God forbid, back with that bass player that gave her a black eye as a parting gift when he ran off with some skeezy groupie. She bounded up the stairs, taking them two at a time. She knocked on her door, but heard nothing. She knocked again, and then a third time. Must be at the bar, she thought to herself. Searching her jeans, she found a business card to a favorite Chinese restaurant and scribbled on it quickly. Luce, checking on you. Hit me up. I need a plus one for an event. Dying for you to see. Hot K. Sliding it under the door, she descended the stairs with a glance back over her shoulder as a nagging feeling bloomed in the pit of her stomach. Karen went to bed that night, exhausted from the day's events, but excited. As she slept, she dreamed of the man in the hat, the rancid meat, vomiting, crying, begging him to let her go. The scrape of the rusty chains that held her. She had to wake up. She had to get out of this nightmare. She woke with a start and looked around and found herself just where she was when sleep had taken her. She wanted to cry, wanted to scream. The dreams were seriously affecting her sleep and focus. What was causing these atrocious nightmares? Was she stressed? When this event is over, I will go to the doctor and see about getting some sleeping pills. She was sore, like she had been in a fight, but she knew it was from lack of sleep. The smell in her nose and the taste in her mouth was making her want to vomit. She made her way to the bathroom, but retched before she made it through the door. As the contents of her stomach emptied onto the floor, the noxious smell of decomposing flesh was stronger than ever. When she was finally finished dry heaving, she stood and felt every bit of energy drained from her body. Fallen to her knees, she wondered if she could even make it back to the bed. She attempted to get to her feet, but made little progress. She collapsed back to the floor and tried to crawl. She felt dizzy and disoriented. She was about 6 feet from the bed when everything went black. Head pounding, she woke sitting on a cold cement floor. Her arms were chained to a large drain pipe running from the floor to the ceiling. She looked around and saw no one. Where was she? How did she get here? It was cold, and there was that spell. It was intense and so familiar. She recognized it as the smell from her dreams, that disgusting, fated odor. She felt her body reacting to the smell as her stomach started to roll, but there was nothing left to discard. She could hear music coming from nearby. What was that? She knew that song. It was Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes. She groaned and looked around the room again. It was bare, except for a metal table in the middle of the room and a drain directly under. She could see another room behind the table with a light on, but there was nothing else visible beyond the doorway. Her head was foggy and her eyes were blurry. She attempted to pull on the chains. They did not budge. She yanked again, harder. Nothing. She didn't know what to do or how she was going to get out of here. She frantically looked around for any kind of object that might aid in her escape. Seeing nothing, she collapsed back against the wall. She was just about to let the exhaustion take her once more when she heard a sound. She looked to her right, where from out of the blackness, she saw the figure of a man coming towards her. Her breath caught in her throat. As he neared the light, the fading shadows bred familiarity. It was the man from her dreams. His hat was in place, and he was looking towards the floor. A strangled scream began to rise from her throat, and as it did, the man raised his head to meet her eyes. A new recognition dawned.
She screamed as loud as she ever had. It was the basement creep. What in the fuck was he doing here? He smiled sideways.
So, we meet again, my sweet Karen.
She narrowed her eyes at him. Where am I? What am I doing here? He looked surprised.
My sweet darling, don't you know your own love nest when you see it?
She looked at him, eyes ablaze. What are you talking about, you psychotic fuck? Let me go! A slight smile crept across his face. He reached down and pulled her chin up to meet his gaze.
You're the one I've been waiting for. Don't you see? All the others, they were weak. But not you. You're so strong.
A sob attempted to escape her throat, but she choked it off. He was not going to get the satisfaction of knowing he scared her. He walked over to the table and picked up a metal bowl. He swirled around the contents. She couldn't see it, but she could smell it. She gagged involuntarily. She knew that smell as well as she knew her own name. It was the smell that had plagued her dreams and mornings alike. It smelled like death. He looked at her with a crooked grin.
Are you hungry, my love? It's all been working out exactly as planned. I've taken the best parts of them and given them to you to make my perfect mate.
She didn't know what to say. She didn't understand what was happening. He sauntered towards her with the bowl in one hand and a large spoon in the other. He snaked the spoon into the bowl and came out with a heaping pile of bloody, rotten meat and what appeared to be teeth. Bile began to rise in her throat. She spat in his face, then screamed, "Get away from me, asshole!" He shook his head.
Honey, please don't do that. It makes me angry, and I want this to be very special between us. You've never minded your vitamins before, so be a good girl and take them for Daddy.
She began to sob. The man backed away from us slowly and placed the bowl back on the table.
You know, all the other girls before you prepared me for this moment. The moment when I could make my most perfect girl. Feeding you the best parts of them has made you into my personal science experiment. But it has worked out so nicely. They all screamed and screamed until I had no choice but to shut them up. And that Lucy, well, she was a fighter.
Karen gasped as understanding hit her. She had been force-fed her friend. Her stomach heaved in response. She began to cry again. Why? Why are you doing this? He began to walk back to the table and did not attempt to answer her question. She screamed, "Answer me, damn it!" He looked back at her, shocked, and picked up a large drill with a spade bit on the end, then pointed it at her.
Enough playing around. We are going to get this done tonight. And then, you will finally be all mine.
He headed towards her, squeezing the drill trigger every few seconds for effect. When he reached her, she scrambled as close to the wall as she could get, pulling her chains as hot, fresh tears fell from her eyes. He grabbed the back of her hair and kissed her as she tried to turn away.
It's our turn, baby. We're going to be together forever.
He said as he placed the drill to the side of her knee. As he pulled the trigger, a fine spray of blood hit his face. She screamed, and all awareness was gone. Regaining consciousness, she was alone again. She looked around apprehensively. She was in excruciating pain. She looked down and saw that in the holes he had drilled, he had placed hinges. She had hinges attached to her knees, hips, and ankles. She screamed as loud as she could and tried moving her legs to no avail. Next, she tried to grab her legs to forcibly move them, but couldn't do that either, as there were hinges on her elbows, wrists, and shoulders as well. In shock, she fell over on her right side. She didn't know what to do. She was unable to move her arms or legs on her own accord. She had to think of a way to get out of here, a way to escape. As she was lying there, attempted to think, footsteps echoed into the room. She looked up as he entered.
It was so hard to keep track of you. I had to install my surveillance equipment in your apartment, and your car, and your office. It got a bit tiresome. When I decided to start putting sleeping pills in your bottle of Pinot Noir, I could do whatever I wanted with you at night. Oh, what fun times we've had.
He held a black box out to her that had several buttons on it. He chuckled.
However, it's time that your free will comes to an end, and my absolute control begins.
He walked back over to the metal table and picked up the drill. He replaced the drill bit with a different one and picked up a liquid, greenish-blue tube.
After I put my new creation into that little brain of yours, you'll have no choice but to do my bidding. Of course, you won't be the same that you were, but you'll still retain some of your best qualities. And I will have the woman I've always wanted.
He smiled at her, but she closed her eyes and turned her face away. He walked behind her and lifted her hair.
I want to do this in the best place so that your hair will cover the scar. We don't want to mess up this beautiful head of yours.
She began to scream and jerk against her chains. She twisted her head back and forth to keep him away. He righted his grip on her hair and wound it round his wrist so that she could not move. Just as she felt the tip of the drill touch her skin, she saw movement from the shadows. Looking up, she saw Miss Wyndham, her landlord, step forward. "Oh, thank God," her mind screamed, followed by her pleading voice. "Miss Wyndham, help me, please. He's crazy. Call 911. Miss Wyndham didn't say anything, just gave Karen a sad smile. Right before her mind went dark, she heard the basement asshole say,
"Mother, so glad you could join us. You always get the best girls for me."
You've been listening to Body Alterations by author Dawn Shea. Dawn, an avid lover of horror for most her life, went from a small dream of an ABC-based anthology to now publishing other authors' work. Our main goal at her publishing house, called D&T Publishing, is to spread more authors' words out into the world. Our second tale comes to us from author T.W. Grimm and features voice talents Melissa Medina, Justine Anastasia, and Paul J. McSorley. Join us as we take a front row seat to the eternal investigation about an incident at a national park where three people went missing and a fourth was found dead in his home. Oof, kind of makes you want to skip that next hike, right? And now, without further ado, from author T.W. Grimm, I give you Venus is Falling.
The following is a faithful reenactment that is based on a series of audio tape recordings, transcriptions of radio communications, and a copy of an uncensored police report I obtained from a source that, for reasons of personal safety, must remain anonymous. I've also included excerpts from an emotionally charged interview with the widow of a man who witnessed the events in question. the existence of these recordings and transcripts has been officially and repeatedly denied by the National Park Service, the FBI, local law enforcement, and a number of officials representing the U.S. military. However, despite the official stance that the incident was an elaborate hoax, the audio recorded that night by Park Ranger Matthew Golding was leaked by an unidentified source in the fall of 2010, along with the radio transcripts and the police report. The forbidden files were uploaded to an infamous website known for hosting controversial material. The illicit materials disappeared from the site in short order, but they have periodically resurfaced on other file-sharing websites over the years. If one is persistent enough, it is possible to find them. But if you do, be prepared to spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder. People who obtain these files have a tendency to disappear. In the interest of staying both alive and well, I have chosen to omit the name of the national park where the incident occurred. I also took the liberty of altering both the names and exact ages of all parties involved. The location will be referred to as X National Park, and the witnesses shall be named as follows. Matthew Golding, 31, a National Park Service Forest Ranger and Law Enforcement Officer. Jillian Bridgemore, 36, an NPS Ranger, Law Enforcement Officer, and a respected authority in wildland fire suppression. Nicholas Fazio, 53, a trusted volunteer who was manning the radio at the base of operations that evening. Maria Fazio, 48, a laborer at a local manufacturing facility and the wife of Nicholas Fazio. And Louis Delacroix, 42, a veteran fire lookout who was serving his 20th season in the watchtower. Three people went missing that night, never to be seen again, and a fourth was found dead in his home only 3 days later. Maria Fazio discovered the body of her husband slumped over the kitchen table, his hand still wrapped around his coffee mug as his blood soaked into the morning newspaper. He had been shot in the back of the head with a .40 caliber firearm. The coroner initially stated that his death was a homicide, but the ruling was quickly changed to suicide by a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Maria Fazio was adamant that her husband had never owned a handgun. According to the uncensored police report, no weapon was found at the scene. So, who murdered Nicholas Fazio? And why was his murder covered up by the police?
I've never seen anything like it. They're... Ants to them. To get out of there. But my compass was spinning in circles. I saw them floating over the treetops. Screaming. Dickie, I saw them screaming in the light.
Calm down, Lou. Listen, we're gonna get you out of there. We're gonna, just tell me again where...
Holy God, they're coming. Look to the southeast, do you see it? It's just gliding over the treetops like... Oh, do you see it?
Hey, what... Lewis, what is that? I can see... There's... And now it's changing colors. It's... I lost sight of it. What do you see on your end? What's happening?
They're coming for me. Oh, I'm scared, Nicky.
You've got a shotgun in there. Use it if you have to, Lou. Don't think twice about it.
They don't care about no shotgun. Before they get me, I'm telling you right now, I will blow my goddamn head off.
My husband didn't own a gun. I would never allow one in the house. I mean, even if he did have a gun, how could he shoot himself like that twice in the back of the head? Yeah, they left that part out. He was shot twice, not once. He couldn't have done that to himself. Didn't make any sense. After the ruling came out, I hounded them every damn day. Every day, I would call them, no word of a lie, every single day. I would go down there in person sometimes, and I'd demand they reopen the investigation. I mean, I even started calling the office of the governor. I wrote him letters. You know what they said to me? They said, stop calling. It isn't going to bring him back. Yeah, I want everyone to know they said that to me. The office of the governor said that to a grieving widow. Make sure that gets in there.
I will. Maria, why do you think they changed the cause of death in the coroner's report?
They were scared. And everyone I talked to, they sounded like they were afraid. I could hear it in their voices, so I stopped calling them. And there was no point. No one was going to tell me the truth. And if they did, they'd end up like Nick. They'd be killed.
Shortly after 9 p.m., on a clear night in August of 2006, veteran fire lookout Louis Delacroix radioed the base of operations with the startling observation. An unidentified flying object had dropped from the darkening skies and landed in the woods roughly a mile north of the watchtower.
You really didn't see it? Touched down about 3 miles southeast of you, about a mile north of the tower. You didn't see nothing at all?
Negative. I didn't see anything unusual to the southeast. Was it a meteor? You know, a shooting star or something like that?
No. Wasn't no meteor. I've seen a few meteors over the years, and it wasn't like that. It didn't streak across the sky, and it wasn't fast. It came down in a slow, controlled descent, nice and steady. I watched it fly parallel to the treetops, cruising along at maybe 20 miles an hour, and it dropped out of sight. I don't know, it wasn't a flare, and it weren't a parachute. I don't know what to tell you. I couldn't identify it.
Wow. That's really weird.
You're telling me? I have never seen anything like that before. And I've been watching the skies for 20 years. Can you maybe send someone out here?
I'll get a hold of Matt and Jillian.
Well, I don't know, Nicky. I think we got ourselves a UFO out here. I've never seen anything like that before in my entire life.
What do you mean, like a flying saucer or something? Come on, you can't be serious.
I saw what I saw. I don't know what to say. I'm a little freaked out, Nicky. Tell him to get out here quick. Just tell him it's an emergency.
Nick didn't come home that night. I tried to call him at least a dozen times, but he wouldn't answer the phone. I called the police and asked them to go check on him, and they told me, don't worry, everything's fine. And I asked them, how do you know that? You didn't even go out there yet. They just kept saying that everything was fine at the base and I should just go to bed.
What time did your husband come home?
He didn't get in until 2 o'clock the next afternoon. I was worried sick. He looked so tired, and there was something else too. Like, he had this blank look in his eyes. I think he was in shock. I asked him what happened, and the way he stared at me made goosebumps come up on my arms. And he said, they told me not to tell anyone, not even you.
Is this thing recording, or do I have to? Okay. This is Officer Matthew Golding speaking. It's shortly after 9 p.m. on the of August 2006. I'm standing here with Jillian Bridgemore and Louis Delacroix, and, as I said, we're standing here outside the watchtower in National Park. Jillian and I were called out to investigate something, something very unusual that was reported by Mr. Delacroix here. Lou, can you tell us what you saw? Unusual? Yeah, you could say that.
Mr. Delacroix has requested that we document this investigation with a tape recorder he found in the watchtower. Louis, can you tell us what you saw this evening?
Yes, ma'am, I can. Right around 9 o'clock, 2100 hours, I seen a ball of light fall from the sky. It came down about a mile from here. It was pretty big. I'd say maybe 20 feet across in diameter. It turned all kinds of different colors as it came down, One sort of just running into the next, you know? It was pulsing and, I don't know how to describe it, really. Light was just sort of pulsing, going from green to blue, red, orange, all kinds of colors. I'll go on record right now and tell you something. I've been a fire lookout for a real long time, and I've never seen anything like that.
Do you believe in that sort of thing, Mr. Delacroix? UFOs and things of that nature?
I believe what I see with my own eyes, and I am telling you, I seen a ball of light come down from the sky. It flew over the trees in a straight, steady path for maybe 200 yards, and then it just dropped out of sight. I'm not saying it's aliens or something, but, well, hell, I don't know. I can only tell you what I saw.
Matt, no offense to Lewis here, but I don't think this was much of an emergency.
Hold on just a damn minute. I am not a liar, ma'am. I'm telling you the truth. I've known Lou for a long time. If he says something landed out there in the woods, well, I believe he isn't lying to us. And we'll just say that. We might as well check it out. I am not some crazy wingnut. I saw what I saw. Well, I know you aren't, Lou. Believe me, if it was anyone but you, I'd already be heading back. It's been a long day. I want to come too. I want to see it. Oh, I don't think that's a good idea.
Absolutely not.
Come on, I want to see it. I have a camera. Let me come with you.
If you fell off the back of the quad or something, I think we could be held liable. No way. We can't do that.
Please, I'm begging you over here. Come on! I want to see this thing. I want to take 100 pictures and show the whole goddamn world. I promise I will not be a pain in your ass and I won't do anything stupid. Look, Lou, I'll be honest here. I don't think we're going to find an actual physical object from outer space in those woods. We'll take you out there, show you that nothing's there, and back to the watchtower you go.
He's not supposed to abandon his post at the tower. This is... You know what? He's your responsibility, then. He can ride with you.
You're gonna see that I ain't a liar. You're gonna see that for yourself. Mark my words.
Nick didn't say much when he got in. He lay down on the couch and fell asleep. I was really worried about him. Right around 6 o'clock, I took a break from watching over him to go have a smoke, and I saw an unfamiliar vehicle parked a little ways down the street. A big black SUV with tinted windows. I felt like someone was watching me. Made me nervous. When I went back in, Nick was sitting up on the couch. He pointed to the window and said, "Are they out there?" I knew right away what he was talking about. I told him about the SUV, and his face got real pale. He started pacing around the house. He says, "They don't want me to tell anyone." Well, I grabbed him by the arm and asked him, "Tell anyone what, Nick? What happened out there last night?" And he just shook his head and whispered in my ear, "I can't say anything, they're listening." I felt the hairs raise on the back of my neck, and I grabbed a notepad and wrote, "Who's listening?" He shook his head again and grabbed the pen out of my hand, and he wrote, "They can see us." And he ran the tap over the notepad in the kitchen sink. He wadded it up in a ball and threw it in the garbage.
Did you look for this notepad after your husband's murder?
Yes. I searched for it after they took him away. It wasn't there. I dumped the bag out on the kitchen floor and looked through all the garbage, but it just wasn't there. It was gone.
Maria, who do you believe was responsible for the death of your husband?
The real question is, who ordered his execution? Because it was an execution. My husband knew something he wasn't supposed to know. They were worried he would tell someone. That's why he wouldn't say anything. He was afraid they would find out with their surveillance equipment. He was trying to protect me.
What do you think would have happened if Nick had told you the truth.
I think you know the answer to that. One more death to these people? Our lives don't matter to people like that.
Who are you referring to when you say that? Who are they? And what are they trying to hide?
I think you already know the answer to that one, too.
Shortly after 9 p.m., Matthew Golding, Jillian Bridgemore, and Louis Delacroix left the watchtower on two all-terrain vehicles, following a rough trail that meanders on a northwesterly path through the forest. Before they left, Louis radioed back to base to advise Nick Fazio that the trio intended to venture out and locate the mysterious object which had descended from the sky. It was the second last transmission sent from the watchtower that evening.
Goddamn, that's something, isn't it? That's really something. You guys be careful, Lou.
Well, I just want to get some pictures, Nicky. I ain't gonna walk up and touch the damn thing. We're not stupid.
Listen, Louis. Jokes aside, if you find what you're looking for out there, don't get too close, you know? Be cautious. You don't know anything about it. You don't know what it is or where it came from. It could be dangerous.
I already told you I am not an idiot. Damn it, this is big, man. This is huge. We are gonna be famous. TV talk shows and all that jazz. Reporters.
Famous? You get a clear picture of some aliens out there, and I bet we'll all freaking disappear. I mean it, Lou. You guys be careful.
We'll be fine. But don't worry about it. Over and out, buddy. We'll talk soon.
The time is, it's 9:24 p.m. We parked the quads on the side of the trail and went into the woods on foot. We are approximately 1 mile north of the tower, and we can see a light shining through the trees. It's... I don't know what to make of this. Jillian?
I think I should apologize to Louis over here. There's an object in the woods, about 200 or 300 yards to the west of the trail. I can't see its shape, but it's a brightly lit object, and it seems to be changing colors in a pattern. We're too far away to make out any detail, but this thing, it's pretty big. I don't know how Nick didn't see this thing. It's very bright.
I told you, I ain't a liar. Well, no one ever called you a liar. We just didn't... Wait. What the hell is that? I can hear something. I can feel it. Like it's...
I can feel it too. Can you smell that? There's a weird smell, almost like ozone. I can taste it on my tongue.
Oh, okay, let's consider our options here. I am not sure if getting close and taking pictures is such a great idea, Lou. We should keep our distance.
Shh. Do you hear that? Something's coming this way.
Oh, shit on that. Let's go. Louis, do not leave my sight, you... Louis! Louis! Wait!
We have to go. Come on.
Okay, just a second.
A massive search operation was quickly organized to locate the missing rangers and the fire lookout. But after 9 days, the searchers were forced to throw in the towel. Every acre of the park was carefully combed for any clues that might shed some light on their fate. In the end, all they could find was a small scrap of cloth that may have come from a ranger's uniform, a single button, the tire tracks from their all-terrain vehicles, the tape recorder, and Matthew Golding's 9mm pistol. The scrap of cloth was discovered a few yards outside the burn spot. It was snagged on a low-hanging branch, affirming that at least one of the rangers came very close to the landing site. The button was on the ground nearby, partially melted. It was impossible to determine which of the missing persons these items may have belonged to, but it is almost certain they both came from a ranger's uniform. The tape recorder was laying in the burned vegetation near the edge of the eye. The outer casing of the tape recorder was badly melted, but the cassette inside proved to be largely unscathed. The discovery of the firearm occurred by pure accident. A member of the search team happened to look up at the right time, and she caught sight of a pistol dangling from a tree branch. The branch in question was 79 feet in the air. The firearm was determined to belong to Matthew Golding. Upon closer examination, the searchers made a grisly discovery. There was a crust of blackened organic material attached to the grip, which was eventually identified as being a thick layer of human skin. It appeared that Golding's weapon was torn from his grasp after being heated to searing temperatures. The weapon itself, however, appeared to have sustained only minor damage. The entire event is shrouded in mystery, but the strangest piece of the puzzle is the area known as the burn spot. The burn spot is a roughly circular patch of land where all the vegetation was seared to a crisp by an unknown source of heat. The trees along the border of the burn spot had been singed all the way up to the uppermost branches on one side, but were largely undamaged on the other side. In the middle of this 40-foot-wide patch of devastation, there was a perfect circle of bleached-out soil that was dubbed the Eye by the search team. The undergrowth located within this area hadn't been scorched, but it was uniformly crushed into the forest floor in a swirling circular pattern. The Eye reaches 12 inches deep into the soil, and it measures over 20 feet in diameter. According to the police report, the ground inside the Eye remained warm to the touch for over 72 hours. There was a quiet concern among the ranks of the search team that the area might have been irradiated, but there was no elevated levels of harmful radiation detected within either the Eye or the surrounding burn spot. It has been reported that, even years later, nothing will grow within the burn spot. Wildlife has been observed giving it a very wide berth, including birds and flying insects, who will actively change their flight path to avoid crossing through the airspace above the affected area. Unknown persons were observed taking soil and vegetation samples from the burn spot on the day after the abduction, but the results of any analysis that might have been performed on these samples remains unknown. How could it be possible to burn such a large area of dry undergrowth without sparking a raging wildfire? The entire region was in the grip of a heat wave, and there had been minimal rainfall in the weeks leading up to the incident. In those conditions, a stray ember from a campfire could easily start a devastating inferno. One can only wonder about the nature of an energy field which could accomplish such a feat, and how it might be produced, and for what purpose. No one knows the true answer beyond a select few, an anonymous and faceless cabal that protects its secrets with money, intimidation, and cold-blooded murder.
Oh, shit! Shit! Okay. I don't know what time it is. My watch stopped. Radio doesn't work either. Just a lot of static. Lou, he's gone. We lost him. There was something coming at us. I don't know. We could hear like a... I don't even know how to describe it.
It was a deep hum. I could hear something pushing through the undergrowth, and that humming sound. My head started to hurt. It was hard to breathe.
Lou took off in a different direction and we lost him. He's still out there somewhere.
I'm sorry, but I'm leaving right now. There's no way I'm going back out there.
We can't leave without him, Joe. Do you know how much?
We never should have brought him with us in the first place. Are you out of your goddamn mind? Whatever's out there in the woods, it's beyond us. Way beyond us. Who knows what could happen if it sees us?
Look, Jill, I have known Lou for years, and I can't do it. There's no choice.
There is a choice. I choose to go home tonight, and you should do the same. Whatever or whoever is out there, they might mean us harm, and they might not. Sometimes I'll step on a bug by accident, and sometimes I do it on purpose. Either way, that bug is dead. You get what I'm saying?
We are still recording here, Jill.
I don't give a shit. You can do whatever you want, but I'm out of here.
No. Stop right there and drop the key.
Hey! What the fuck are you doing pointing your gun at me?
Put your weapon on the ground. Bear spray, knife, radio. Put everything on the ground. No! Shut up! Do not talk. Take 6 big steps backward and turn around with your hands in the air.
What are you doing? What the hell is going on here, Matt?
If you speak again, I'll kill you. Do you understand? Good. Keep your mouth shut and do as I say. Start walking.
Oh, I'm pretty much an expert by now, sure. Ask whatever you want.
Let's talk about Matthew Golding for a minute.
Well, I guess people are gonna think this is crazy, but it's all crazy, so, we know that Matthew Golding was born in 1975. He moved to the state of with his family when he was a teenager, and he started in the park in the fall of 1998. He appeared almost 8 years later on the night of what happened, and that was the last anyone ever saw of him. Are you with me so far?
Yes, ma'am. Please continue.
Well, a couple of fishermen found a skull in a ravine back in 2011. It was identified as belonging to Matthew Golding. He'd been shot in the back of the head. Now, at first they were estimating the year of his death to be sometime in 2002, but that got changed to 2006 in the report.
So, you're suggesting that Matthew died 4 years before the abduction? How is that possible? His voice can be heard numerous times in the recording.
The man you hear in the recording wasn't the real Matthew Golding. He was dead long before then. Mr. Golding was murdered and replaced with a lookalike in 2002. The man on the tape is an imposter.
Where would they find someone who could look and act so closely to the real person? And why? It's been documented that Matthew came home for the Christmas holidays every year, and even his own family didn't notice anything off about him.
There's been a lot of very strange sightings in that park over the years. Look it up for yourself. It's been going on for at least 100 years, maybe even longer. I think they've been watching the park for a very long time now, and they'll protect their secret any way they can. Now, there was a letter that Matthew wrote to his parents in March of 2001, and I've seen this letter with my own eyes, where he says he saw a strange light in the sky. He thought it was Venus at first, but it fell from the sky and landed somewhere in the park. That's what he says in the letter. He says, "I thought to myself, Venus is falling." So he did see something unusual, and maybe it was more than once. Maybe he told someone about it, and they turned out to be the wrong person. You know, maybe they were reading his mail. They can do that. They can make you disappear, and they can even replace you. They have unlimited money and resources, these people. They can do whatever they want.
What is the secret they're trying to protect?
I know what people think when you say something like this, but I do believe there are other civilizations out there, and they're much more advanced than we are. That's not the secret, though. The secret is, they've been coming to our planet for a very long time. They come here for reasons we don't understand, and they do what they do, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. That's what they're trying to hide from the public, you understand. The real secret isn't that we're being, interfered with, you know? The secret is that we don't know what they want, and we're helpless to stop them.
I have one more question concerning Matthew Golding. Why do you think he recorded himself committing a felony by holding a fellow law enforcement officer hostage? You would think someone in his position would want to get rid of Jillian and Lewis without leaving any evidence behind.
Well, he wasn't worried about the tape falling into the wrong hands. He was probably going to send it straight to a lab somewhere for analysis if things had turned out the way he'd planned. He was going to kill Jillian and Lewis, no doubt about it. He wasn't going to let them get out of there alive.
It might have been better for them if he had. The final minute of the tape is absolutely terrifying. I've listened to it a dozen times, and it still makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck.
I feel for Jillian and Lewis, but as far as I'm concerned, that murdering son of a bitch got what he deserved, sir. He got exactly what he deserved.
There's an opening on the side. The fucking thing, it's changing all the time, like I mean, it's a circle, then it's like a star. It doesn't stop changing, it's... Oh, fuck. It just opened up.
What do you mean? Like a door or something?
No, it's a... I don't know, it's not like a door. There's... Out of the opening. What hurts to look at? I don't know how. Oh, wait a minute. What's that? Shit.
What's going on? Talk to me, Lewis. What do you see?
Something just came out of there. I can't, I mean, there's more. There's even more of them. Oh my God, sweet Jesus, the way they move.
Calm down. I called the cops, so help is on the way. Just lay low, okay? Stay away from the...
They know I'm here. They know I'm talking to you.
Can they see you?
They can see everything.
The imposter, who was masquerading as Matthew Goldman, led Jillian Bridgemore through the woods for approximately 17 minutes. During that time, no audible communication between them was captured on tape. The disquieting hum that could be heard earlier in the recording reappears, and it grows steadily louder, as if Matthew and his captive were inadvertently drifting closer and closer to the object as they search for Lewis Delacroix. At one point, Lewis can be heard yelling their names in the background, suggesting he was in close enough proximity to the Rangers to be picked up by the cheap microphone in the tape recorder. Although these conclusions are largely speculation, they generate two very puzzling questions. How did the imposter not realize he was wandering too close to the landing site? And why didn't he answer Lewis when he was obviously close enough to be heard? It can be speculated that the object in the woods was exerting some kind of temporal disturbance in the immediate area of the landing site, distorting time and space in a way that would confuse the senses. It's possible Lewis was walking almost right beside them, but they were unable to see or perceive each other in any tangible manner. I think it's highly unlikely the agent posing as Matthew would knowingly approach the object, as he would have been well aware of the dangers it posed to any earthly being that might stray too close. I believe he simply became disoriented and wandered in the wrong direction, with disastrous results. Although I grieve the loss of Jillian Bridgemore, I'm afraid I have to agree with Maria Fazio concerning the fate of the murderous imposter. That son of a bitch had it coming.
I can't see. Stop right there. We have... Oh, shit. Oh, holy fuck.
Oh, my God. The light.
was in the shower when it happened. He was sitting at the table, drinking his coffee. He had the morning newspaper open in front of him. When I, got out of the shower, he was slumped over the table. His... Oh, God, the blood. The newspaper was soaking up his blood.
You didn't hear any gunshots?
I thought maybe I had heard something, but it wasn't a really loud bang, you know, like the bang from a gunshot. Your guts are very loud. There's no way I wouldn't hear two shots over the sound of the running water, not unless the killer was using a suppressor. I've read about those things. It's not like in the movies. They change the sound of the gunshot.
Tell me about the encounter you had after the funeral.
Well, it was about a week after the funeral, and I was just sort of moping around the house. I wasn't really thinking straight. I was still trying to make some sense of it all, you know? Anyway, so this big guy with a crew cut came knocking on the door that morning. He was wearing dark coveralls and mirrored sunglasses. I thought he was with the power company at first. But then I saw he was holding a flower arrangement and a gift bag. He gave me his big smile when I opened the door and he said, "Sorry to intrude like this, Maria, but they wanted to offer their condolences." I just stared at him like, "What the hell is this?" You know? I said, "Pardon me? Who are you?" And he handed me the flowers and the gift bag. I said, "What's this? Tell me who you are." But he was already walking away. He got into a cargo van and drove away. And I just stood there and watched him go with my mouth hanging open. And it was so weird, you know? It was just really scary. I was shaking all over.
What was in the bag?
It was my hairbrush. I keep it in the vanity in my bedroom. I had just used it the night before. I didn't even know it was gone.
They came into your bedroom that night, as you slept, and they took your hairbrush to send a message. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. It was a message. Look, this is how they do it, all right? This is the kind of thing they do. If I told you they broke into my house and stole my brush, well, you'd think I was crazy, wouldn't you? And that's how they do something like this. They want to intimidate you. It was definitely a message. They wanted me to know they can get rid of me anytime they see fit. Locked doors mean nothing to them. If they ever even suspected I had some evidence against them, they'd get rid of me in a heartbeat.
It is widely believed that Louis Delacroix witnessed the abduction of Jillian and the imposter. After witnessing this traumatic event, he was somehow able to find his way back to the watchtower. What follows is the last transmission between Louis and Nicholas Fazio in its entirety. It makes for a very disturbing listening experience, and listener discretion is advised.
Nicky, do you copy? Nick!
Lou, what's wrong?
We went out there and... We went out there, right? And there's something in the woods, Nicky. It's a... And something was coming after us. We all ran and I lost them in the woods and I was yelling for them, but... Anything at all. Like, I couldn't see right. I didn't feel right. Everything was just Everything was just completely off.
Where is Matt and Jillian, Lou? Are they with you now?
Never seen anything like it. They're ants to them and to get out of there. But my compass was spinning in circles. I saw them floating over the treetops. Screaming, Nicky. I saw them screaming in the light.
Calm down, Lou. Listen, we're gonna get you out of there. We're gonna, just tell me again where...
Holy God. They're coming. Look to the... the southeast. Do you see it? It's just gliding over the treetops, like. Do you see it?
Hey, what? Lewis, what is that? I can see. There's. And now it's changing colors. It's. I lost sight of it. What do you see on your end? What's happening?
They're coming for me. I'm scared, Nikki.
You've got a shotgun in there. Use it if you have to, Lou. Don't think twice about it.
They don't care about no shotgun. They... Before they get me, I'm telling you right now, I will blow my goddamn head off.
Don't do that. Lou, what the fuck is going on over there?
There's an opening on the side. The fucking thing. It's changing all the time, like... I mean, it's a circle. Then it's like a star. Doesn't stop changing. It's a... Oh, fuck. It just opened up.
What do you mean? Like a door or something?
No, it's... I don't know. It's not like a door. There's... out of the opening. Oh, it hurts to look at. I don't know how. I... Wait a minute. What's that? Oh, shit.
What's going on? Talk to me, Lewis. What do you see?
Something just came out of there. I can't... I mean... There's more. There's even more of them. Oh, my God. Sweet Jesus, the way they move.
Calm down. I called the cops, so help is on the way. Just lay low, okay? Stay away from the...
They know I'm here. They know I'm talking to you.
Can they see you?
They can see everything.
Stay with me, Lou. Don't do anything rash. Just...
Step away from the radio and come with us. Right now, please. Turn off the...
At this time, there still hasn't been any formal acknowledgement from any authorities at a regional, state, or federal level that would suggest this incident had ever occurred. Maria Fazio continues to strive for the truth behind her husband's murder, and the families of Matthew Golding, Jillian Bridgemore, and Lewis Delacroix continue to mourn the mysterious loss of their loved ones. They desperately seek closure, but this has been denied to them, again and again, by everyone from the chief of police to the governor, all the way up to the Secretary of Defense. The truth will probably never be revealed, but someone, somewhere, knows what happened on that night in August of 2006. It is my hope they will eventually find the courage to come forward with the final pieces of this daunting and sinister puzzle. However, I don't believe it will ever happen. Some secrets are simply far too dangerous to be revealed. I'd like to personally thank you, the listeners, for joining me this evening. I would like to end with a blood-chilling anecdote of my own. Before I began working on this documentary, I was largely skeptical of this story. It sounded like a hybrid between a conspiracy theory and an urban legend. However, shortly before I began production on this documentary, I had an encounter that changed my mind entirely. A man came knocking at my door 2 weeks before production was scheduled to begin. It was a large man with a crew cut, wearing dark coveralls and mirrored sunglasses. When I answered the door, he shoved a cardboard box into my hands, gave me a cryptic smile, then walked away. I yelled, "Hey, come back here," but he didn't even turn around. He jumped into a white cargo van with darkly tinted windows and drove off, here one moment, then gone the next. If I wasn't left standing on my porch with a box in my hands, I would have been tempted to believe it had never happened at all. The encounter was over in a matter of seconds. I wasn't sure if I should even open the box, but I finally gathered enough courage to take a look. There were two items inside. One was a copy of the script for this documentary. At this point, I still haven't even made a printed copy for myself. I was chilled to the bone by this discovery. But the other item was even worse. It was a bullet, and my name had been etched into the casing.
You've been listening to Venus is Falling by author T.W. Grimm. T.W. Grimm is a horror novelist from southwestern Ontario. He's the author of 99 Brief Scenes from the End of the World, Tripping Over Twilight, When the Stars Fall, and The Promises We Make in December. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to me. If you'd like to hear more lengthy tales, be sure to look at my audiobooks, available now on audible.com. Check out the link in the show notes for my ever-growing library of audiobooks. If you'd like to hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, including past episodes of this program, all of our other shows, and hundreds of standalone releases, all of them ad-free and available to download or stream. Thanks so much for your time and for giving our sponsors a try today. When you support our sponsors, you help support this show, and that means a lot to me. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You'll find me personally on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Until next week, listener, when we meet up once again atop the Horror Hill for yet another Dance with Darkness, I bid you good night. Sleep tight, listener, and whatever you do, if you hear scratching at your door, don't open it. The darkness may have found you, but it's up to you to let it in.